From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last spring, 2020, when a college senior was preparing for graduation. For Julia, it had been a lot of work leading up to this moment. She had been diagnosed with depression her freshman year at NAS, but she worked through it. She was ready to celebrate completing the college journey, and she, of course, was not alone. It's a rite of spring, isn't it? For so many college students across the country, well, then COVID hit. There would be no graduation ceremony at all. And slowly, as the weeks passed, she realized that there were some friends and acquaintances that she might not see again at all. She felt isolated, and the symptoms of depression only intensified as she considered what was next, with work, with friends, her own health, and the health of her family. Research indicates that there is a mental health crisis sparked by the pandemic unfolding in young adults age 18 to 24. They have been hit hard by grief and loss. On Healthline, here was a recent headline, quote, "Adults under 24, the loneliest age group during COVID." And here's reporting from ABC News. Quote, in a recent survey conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 63% of 18 to 24-year-olds reported symptoms of anxiety or depression, with 25% reporting increased substance use to deal with that stress, and 25% saying they had seriously considered suicide. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 50% of all lifetime mental illnesses develop by age 14, and 75% develop by age 24. Even when the COVID-19 crisis is over, experts expect that 10% of these adults will have long-lasting effects from mental health issues they are currently dealing with, end quote. So how can we recognize the signs of mental health distress, particularly for young adults? Our guests are here to help and share their stories. Let me welcome them now. Julia Smith is a contributing writer at 585 Magazine and a recent Nazareth College graduate. Julia, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Soren Kilmer is a student at Nazareth College. Soren, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Megan Clifford is a psychotherapist and founder of Wellness Associates of Greater Rochester, specializing in anxiety in emerging adults, teaching the higher education module of mental health first aid coming up in May. Megan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan.
In a moment, we're going to ask Megan to kind of work through some of the specifics from a professional point of view. But I want to ask Julia and Soren to share their stories at the outset. And for listeners who want to share their stories, you can do that. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. We'll take some phone calls later in the hour if you want to do that. I know it can be sensitive or difficult, and I want listeners to know that we reached out to a wide range of people from a wide range of backgrounds, people of color, men, women. So this panel represents people who are able and willing to come on and share their story today, but it's an ongoing discussion that we will continue to have. Julia, take me through last spring. You know, you I think, are emblematic of what so many young adults were facing, which is loss in different ways. What was the spring like for you last year?
The spring was really challenging last year, and it was specifically challenging because of the unknown. So we had gone on spring break and gotten an email saying because of coronavirus, we weren't coming back. And we all held out hope, I think, that this would be over soon enough. But unfortunately, it never did. And of course, we're still in it. And I think that uncertainty piled up and caused symptoms of kind of intensified depression and just the wondering of what's next and how does this end. I applied to jobs and the market was very tough, so I've been working part-time this whole year and living with my dad, who of course I'm worried about in Corona. So it's been a little bit of a challenge, a tightrope walk between worried for the future but also sad for what's lost.
When depression is particularly acute for you, how do you recognize it? Are you getting better at recognizing when it's really kind of creeping in and becoming a problem?
Certainly. This pandemic has made me self-aware, but all the ways that we would cope with it prior to this, going out, you know, going to a friend's house, taking a walk, just the ability to deal with it in kind of healthy, constructive ways. When you're alone at your house, all of a sudden, the ways to cope are gone and you can't change. So it's been important for me to recognize to kind of stop my thinking of looking too far ahead, but also worried for what's happened. I have to keep myself in the moment, and that's through breathing exercises or thankfully being able to call friends and family, but it's definitely a challenge.
Is there one technique or response that you find most effective for yourself when you're having a particularly hard moment?
I think that's the hardest part, is that there isn't one. It's been so challenging. I do think the easiest thing is to just, it's essentially taking deep breaths and kind of visualizing, a calm space and allowing that to kind of pervade and overcome the anxiety. But that's hard to do when you're trying to work or you're worried about your family, and it's certainly difficult, but it has made me more self-aware, and I think I will continue trying to learn about ways that I can deal with it immediately by myself as opposed to relying on external factors for that sort of boost.
Mm-hmm. And Julia, I want to ask you a little bit about what you think you've lost in the last year. And I want to preface that by saying, before this program, in communication with panelists, Julia and Soren, they have a tremendous awareness of the fact that they are struggling at times, but also have certain advantages, whether it's family, places that they can be, supports that they have. So these are young adults who have a tremendous sense of advantage. But at the same time, as we've made clear, and I'm sure Megan Clifford will make clear, that does not mean that people aren't really hurting at times, really struggling, and that loss can be manifested in a lot of different ways and places that are absolutely legitimate. So when I ask you, Julia, when you think about loss in the last year, whether it's a graduation ceremony, the excitement of entering a job market, events, et cetera, all the way down to the fear of loss of people you love, what comes to mind first when you think about loss in the last year?
When I think about loss, I think of the loss of routine, the loss of those potential connections, the people I would see on campus and wave to, who I will probably never see again, the professors I've bonded with, who they themselves are struggling to teach in the post-digital age, and I think of just this idea of being stuck. It feels like you're stuck in a world that has pulled a 360 overnight. And while I am grateful for the level of self-awareness and the time I have had where my family, it certainly reminds me of the time I lost my mother a few years ago, and it's almost it's very, very similar to that sort of grief of losing a loved one itself, because it is as though you are losing almost yourself.
Mm-hmm. And so now, have things improved given the fact that we're seeing vaccination? We're seeing some pretty good trends. I mean, I'm certainly not ready to declare everything's over, and I understand that, but are you feeling more optimistic?
I'm feeling more optimistic, and that's what's been very helpful, is seeing tangible, actionable events. People are getting vaccinated, and people are able to go out more and see those they haven't been able to. So that has been a huge, huge plus. But, of course, that in and of itself will be kind of a learning curve, because we haven't seen anyone for nearly a year in normal ways. And I think it can be very overwhelming. So I think on one hand there's the isolation, but on the other hand it's going to be the readapting to the idea of, okay, I'm going to see people outside of my house regularly every day, and seeing what has happened to our social skills and our ability to kind of interact and socialize.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking forward to getting vaccinated yourself?
Yes, I am. I actually was just vaccinated yesterday,
So
I'm taking a deep breath and I'm feeling so grateful.
Isn't it great?
Yes, I'm very relieved. So it's amazing what that has done in and of itself.
I'm telling you, the medical community should be billing this also. The vaccine is not just vaccinating against COVID. It's a mental health boost. I mean, the feeling, and I'm not trying to be flippant. I mean, it is remarkable, the impact on myself, people I know. So for listeners who haven't had it yet and are looking forward to that, it's an amazing feeling. So, Julia, I'm really glad to hear that for you. Before I turn to Soren for her story, can you just tell me a little bit about, maybe what you look forward to most? Because I certainly take the point that it can be overwhelming to have everything sort of flood back. I think it'll come back slowly. What do you miss the most and are looking forward to the most?
I want to go out to a restaurant. I want to order dinner with friends. And I want to be together. I'm excited for some togetherness.
That's beautiful. Soren Kilmer is a student at Nazareth. Soren, can you take me through your experience of the last year?
Sure. So I am a senior at Nazareth this year. So I have been, I was kind of in the middle of my first semester of senior year when the pandemic hit. I think that the hardest thing for me has been that, you know, I've always had anxiety and I've always struggled with anxiety and depression since I was a child. So I have, you know, come to understand a lot of really good coping mechanisms, and like ways to kind of regulate my moods and things like that. But, I'm the kind of person who really thrives when I kind of know what's coming and can prepare myself. And although like every day feels kind of the same during this pandemic, the future seems extremely uncertain. So I think that the hardest part for me has been just like coming to terms with the fact that I don't know what's coming and I can't really do anything about that. It's definitely made worse by the fact that, you know, like as Julia said, the coping mechanisms that I was relying on before are no longer possible. So even just like seeing friends, or I find myself feeling nervous even just walking in a park or going to the grocery store and things like that. So just like that lack of normalcy just exacerbates everything for sure.
Has it gotten better?
Over time, I think yes. I think that, you know, people are good at kind of acclimating to the situations that they're in. So it has gotten better. I think that, especially with school, I think that even professors have gotten better about, being understanding mm-hmm. with students about the fact that they're going through a tough time right now and things are so difficult for everyone. I think that the fact that there are more measures in place to try to help people get through this has been helpful. But
yeah, and if I could just say, Soren, you know, if you go back a year, a lot of the public discourse about college students was sort of, it was sort of this sneering, well, they're going to make this worse. They're just going to keep partying. They don't care. And boy, you talk about missing the mark. And look, I'm not naive. I mean, people of all ages have been breaking restrictions or going against guidelines and gathering at times. But what we're talking about today is the opposite of what was foretold by all of the cynics, which is the reality is that college students especially are feeling the effects of the isolation and are really hurting from it. When you think about loss in the last year, what comes to mind first for you, Soren?
I've talked a lot recently with friends, and I've seen a lot of, you know, pieces in the media about the idea that, you know, we're all coming to terms with the fact that we just lost, you know, an entire year of opportunity. And, you know, I think that that's really what it is. Like I really miss those small, small things that I took for granted before, like, you know, going out to get coffee with friends or, you know, even just like hugging my mom and my siblings. And I think that losing those little moments is the thing that gets to me when I start thinking about it a lot.
And maybe for older listeners who are struggling to maybe relate a little bit. So I'm 41. I just saw my mother for the first time since 2019. And it was this very strange sensation. I mean, it was pure joy, of course, but it was over the course of 24 hours, I felt like, boy, it doesn't seem like it seems like it's, I haven't seen her in forever. And then it feels like everything is right back to where it was. Like, was it really that long? Did I not see family at all in 2020? And I think that's because the older we get, I mean, it's just a smaller slice of our lives. Whereas for people who are Soren and Julia's age, this is an entire year of their adult life, of which they have had a total of some, for some adults, the first year of adulthood, second year, third. I mean, this is a humongous percentage of their adult lives that was filled with all kinds of excitement and possibilities just taken right away. So it's just different for me at 41 or for someone at 60 or someone at 70. And the perspective, I think, is hard for people who are older to kind of get inside the heads of 18 to 24-year-olds who are struggling so much with this. So what for you, Soren, is the plan for dealing when you either feel that isolation or you wrote to us before the program that, you know, that you feel symptoms of depression? How do you recognize it when it's acute? What do you do with it?
You know, that it's a hard question to answer because I think that, you know, you can kind of tell. It comes in waves. I feel like it's just you kind of know when it's going to be a bad day, and you have to kind of plan ahead. Like, you know, what are the things that I can maybe set aside and think about later? What are the things that I really need to get done? And just like being kind with yourself and being patient with yourself. And I'm really lucky to live with my parents during this entire thing. It's really helpful to just be able to go downstairs and have someone to laugh with, if I'm really struggling. That's a big thing for me.
Yeah, I think that's important. Well, let me ask Megan Clifford now, Megan is a psychotherapist, the founder of Wellness Associates of Greater Rochester, and specializes in anxiety in emerging adults. You know, we've just heard two stories. Everyone's story is a little different, but how much do these line up with what you have been experiencing in patients, Megan?
Both Julia and Soren just articulated so beautifully what I am seeing with the emerging adults I work with in my practice. This persistent kind of grief that we are all experiencing, and especially with emerging adults, so much grief and loss. And I think a lot of that is, you know, we have ideas and expectations about how things are going to be, and we get our hopes and dreams, you know, kind of pinned on those things. And then COVID just ripped the world out from under this, from all of us, but especially this age group. I mentioned that I've seen the most difficulty with students who were seniors going in through freshmen into their first year, freshman year. And then also the population where Julia is, that we're graduating seniors that are trying to enter the workforce. That's where I saw the most difficulty. But across the board, students were really dealing with this. And there's a name for what you ladies are talking about. It's called ambiguous loss. We have a name for it in psychotherapy. Ambiguous loss of we're having this grieving, like a living loss. So that something that goes on, and you don't know when it's going to end. Mm-hmm. So when we do have a death or something, you know, we go through this process and we can go through the different phases, quote unquote. Not a big fan of a phase thing, but you know, you just don't know when it's going to end, just like, you know, other experiences in our life where there's a loss. So I think both Julia and Soren really hit the mark on the head with what I'm doing with so many folks is processing and naming and validating. This year has sucked. This year has taken so much from you. So how do we, you know, bring ourselves back to today and live as much as we can today while holding on to hope for the future?
Yeah. And so, Megan, I think there's so many people who are relating to what Soren and Julia have shared. Joe sends us a note saying, Evan, the real question is, do I know any young adults who are not struggling with their mental health right now? I hear you, Joe. And I appreciate the sentiment of solidarity there. Megan, when you heard Soren and Julia describing how they've come to try to recognize when they are more acutely struggling, and maybe some of the steps they're trying to take, given that they are somewhat limited during the pandemic. Can you maybe share some thoughts with coping and how you think they're handling it? And then in more generally, knowing that everyone's different, what are some things you want people to keep in mind?
Well, I think, you know, with Julie and Soren, they do have wonderful self-awareness and they have familiarity with, you know, struggling with some mental health issues before the pandemic. So they have some, you know, education. And I think that's so important to kind of know what would trigger symptoms for you or know what would exacerbate things. But when I'm thinking about the higher education population or anyone I work with, especially when they're coming in with anxiety and depression, there's really what I call the big four. So I ask in my assessment, okay, how, you know, are you exercising? Are you eating? Are you sleeping? Are you staying connected to people? And when you think of, let's use the example of students who are living on campus right now, you know, the gym might be the place where they exercise, where they also connect, right? Well, that's not an option right now. The dining hall is where they eat and can choose healthy foods and can connect. Not an option right now. You know, sleep with pervasive anxiety, we know that sleep is affected. Poor sleep is a huge indicator or symptom of depression. And then, you know, you're moving in or you're living with people in a dorm room, but you're stuck with them. You can't socialize outside of that. Inevitably, that's going to cause strain on any relationship. And then, you know, that whole underlying thing, like, you know, we're social creatures. We are wired to connect. And when that is taken away from us, it's inevitable that we're going to struggle. I mean, even the students I work with who are introverts who are like, yes, COVID, I don't have to interact. They're struggling and they're recognizing, yes, you know, I'm really struggling without being able to feel the energy of a loved one or a friend, or even, I think you said, Julia, you know, walking down the pathway and just saying hello to familiar faces or professors. So those big four are not available. And those are the things I always talk about first with coping.
I do also want to mention that I have learned so much on this program about what I thought I knew but did not know about the difference between introversion and extroversion and what it really does mean and what it does not mean. I'll just ask, Soren, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
I would consider myself an introvert for sure.
Okay. And Julia, for you?
I think I might be an extrovert. I'm a little outgoing.
Yeah, and so I generally, and this is where Megan will help me out here. What I've come to understand about introversion and extroversion is it's not just simply people who are shy or don't like being around others. It's about where you derive your energy. Do you like being around
Absolutely.
People, and do you get energy from it? Are you energized by being in groups? Or do you find that somewhat exhausting and that solitude is where you find a little bit more energy and sort of where you get filled up more? That doesn't mean, I don't think, Megan, that introverts don't need connection. It's just a different source of energy.
Yeah, I was a little bit tongue in cheek there. You're right, you know, from my understanding in the way I perceive introvert and extrovert. I also love to use the word ambivert. So there's people who get charged in some ways and people who get drained and kind of need to do the combo. But I definitely, extroverts are people who get their energy from others. Introverts, you know, it's not that they're not social or it's just they might prefer to be with, you know, a few people versus a large group, or after being in a party or a large group, they're just really tired and need to recharge. So that's how I see the difference. And then, as I said, the ambiverts are kind of in the middle. I'm an ambivert. I need a little each.
I am certainly an ambivert, and I appreciate that term, too. Soren, so for you, for someone who is an introvert, I think Megan is making a really valuable point for all of us who maybe went into the pandemic thinking, well, this will be easy for introverts. How do you sort of square up your own introversion with the need for connection and maybe some of how people might misunderstand what you need?
I think for me personally, it's kind of like a comfort level thing. So I do get my energy from being alone and doing activities on my own, but I also, you know, being around people who care about you and who you making connections with people can lift your spirits in a way that like reading a book by yourself can't. Like, it's just a completely different experience. So I think that, like, you know, I'm not getting that feeling of connection from the people that I'm comfortable with, which is what's really important. Like, there are people that I'm comfortable with who do fuel me. Like, spending time with them does fuel me, and not getting that is hard.
Okay. And Julia, did you find yourself trying to do Zoom game nights, anything like, I'm thinking of what a 40-year-old myself did. What did you do?
Yes. My friends and I from different friend groups, we were all scheduling kind of Zoom cocktail hours, trying to stay in touch. But we realized, oh man, this is hard to get to keep doing. And that's hard. I really miss my people. And that's, it's a struggle. It's different when you're on Zoom, you know? So
yeah,
just seeing them in person.
Yeah, absolutely. So after we take our only break of the hour, I'm going to take some listener feedback. And I think Megan Clifford is really well positioned to help us understand a number of things. First of all, we've got an email from a listener who's asking about the difference between what we might call situational depression or clinical or diagnosable depression, as Andrew puts it. So we'll talk about that. Another listener is asking about medication and whether we are seeing increases in prescribed medication or if there is something to be concerned about with medication. We can talk about that. Maura and Victor will take your phone call after this only break. And we're going to come back with our guests. Soren Kilmer is a student at Nazareth College, and Julia Smith is a recent graduate and a contributing writer at 585 Magazine. Megan Clifford is a psychotherapist and founder of Wellness Associates of Greater Rochester, specializes in anxiety in emerging adults, and teaches the higher education module of Mental Health First Aid. That's coming up in May. So let's take that break, and we're right back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, the Levine Center to End Hate is partnering with Monroe Community College, presenting a series of conversations about the history of racism and xenophobia and bigotry targeting Asian Americans in this country. That is, of course, a very sensitive and timely subject given recent attacks and incidents. That's our discussion next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You can email us, connections@wxxi.org, or call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The CDC reports that there is a real concern about symptoms of anxiety and depression, substance use and abuse, and suicidal ideation in the age group of 18 to 24-year-olds. So young adults particularly hit the hardest by this pandemic when it comes to a mental health crisis, and it's a question of what we do with that. Andrew emails to ask, is there a difference between clinical or diagnosable depression and the feeling of depression or being down from the circumstances of the last year? Megan Clifford?
So I think, Evan, when people think of situational depression, it's usually responding to something that has happened. So COVID is a good example of that. If you're looking from the medical model, that is considered something that we can diagnose, and it's called adjustment disorder, you know, with depression or adjustment disorder with anxiety. So people may be having symptoms of what we could traditionally think is clinical, and I can speak to that in a minute, but it doesn't last as long. It may not be as severe, and it usually resolves within 6 months. So you're responding to something. And if somebody even has a trusted friend, it's wonderful if they could see a therapist, but a trusted friend or somebody that they can process what's going on with that situation, they oftentimes can mitigate some of those symptoms. Clinical depression, on the other hand, it's pervasive symptoms, loss of interest, poor concentration, low mood, problems with sleep, loss of appetite. There's a lot of different symptoms. But that happens consistently, a minimum of 2 weeks, and it goes on, and it's more intense. And the way that I would make the differentiation between situational and clinical would be, what degree are these symptoms affecting a person's ability to function in their life? And when I think of those, there's three things I think of. Is it affecting their ability to take care of themselves in terms of, can I get out of bed? Can I take a shower? Is it affecting their relationships? So one of the symptoms of depression that gets missed often is irritability. So am I being really short fused with my roommate or my parents? And then the other one is, am I able to attend, go to school or work? So one of the things I've seen a lot, especially with this being on Zoom, is how do I stay engaged in these Zoom classes, right? If I'm already depressed, I can't get out of bed, I can't concentrate, my memory's, in rough shape, all of these symptoms of depression, how am I going to go to school? And this was a problem even for people even before COVID. So looking at those, again, those three things, can I get up and take care of myself? Is it affecting my relationships? And am I able to go to school or work? So that's when I would start to look more in terms of the clinical depression.
Angela wants to know if we are medicating more and if we should be medicating more for it.
I'm not a medical professional. I work very closely with medical professionals, psychiatric nurse practitioners, psychiatrists. My perspective is that medication has its place depending on where you are on the spectrum of adjustment disorder up to severe major depressive disorder or any spectrum of a mental health concern. Sometimes if you're dealing with an adjustment disorder, just talking to somebody can be enough. Sometimes if your symptoms are, pretty rough, even for that short period of time, you might need some medication to take the edge off symptoms that will help you process those things. All the way up to somebody who might have severe depression, if you can't get out of bed, if you can't, get to work, you may really need to look at taking medication to manage the biological components of depression. So I can't say whether, what I could recommend. When we're looking overall in psychiatry, usually we look at when there's a diagnosed mental health condition, looking at psychotherapy and the combination of medication usually is what we're looking at. But it doesn't mean people couldn't get better with one or the other.
Sure. And everyone's different. Everyone has different needs. Absolutely. And will respond differently to different treatments. So there is no one size fits all. I've mentioned many times there's a lot of depression, diagnosed depression in my family. I have seen the benefits of multiple approaches. I have seen the benefits of medication. I've seen the concern. When a loved one decides I'm quote unquote strong enough not to need it anymore and goes on their own with that. So I mean, it's complex and every situation is different. But one of the battles has been taking away any stigma associated with people who do end up taking medication for depression. And I am hopeful that Soren and Julia's generation maybe sees it differently. I mean, Julia, when someone needs medication for depression, I know you can't speak for an entire generation, but generally speaking, is it viewed with any stigma, derision at all, or is it viewed as just a legitimate medical need?
I think most people would view it as a legitimate medical need, especially given how many people have been affected by it in our generation. But that being said, there is a lot of discomfort around the idea of just taking the meds themselves, of needing something, of not being, again, what you said, Evan, quote-unquote, strong enough to make it through the day without having to medicate. So that there is a challenge there for sure, but I would say most people understand that it's a medical concern, and if not themselves deal with it, know someone who they intimately understand who has it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has always been, for some reason, viewed mental health viewed differently compared to just health. I mean, if you broke your ankle and you were taking medication to deal with either the healing or the pain for a little while, that would nobody would sort of blink about that. But, people take heart medication. People take all kinds of things, blood pressure. But I take Julia's point there. Soren, how do you think medication for depression is viewed, generally speaking?
I would agree with Julia. I mean, I think that at least within my circles, it's both fairly common and fairly well accepted. I think that it's become a lot more normal to talk about taking medication and even just experiencing difficulties with mental health in general, which I think is wonderful.
I'm glad to hear that. Let me get an email from a listener named Sherry, and I'll direct this one to Megan Clifford. Sherry says, Evan, I'm a therapist in a college town, and I appreciate this topic. Can you discuss the impact of the pandemic on people with social anxiety? I'm really worried about these patients because not only are they missing out on opportunities to challenge their anxiety, but social distancing is actually reinforcing them. How do we treat social anxiety in the age of COVID? Again, that's from Sherry. Megan Clifford?
I love to do some consultation with Sherry because this is such a challenge right now for us as therapists to, you know, a lot of our, especially the younger people that I work with, you know, adolescent into emerging adult, they're like, this is great. I don't have to go to that party. I don't have to raise my hand in class because, you know, it soothes. And what we know about social anxiety is that exposure, just as Sherry said, exposure is how we treat that. You know, gently exposing people to sit with the discomfort of that is really the evidence-based treatment. So right now we don't have that option. So I would say right now I don't really have an answer to that, particularly how to deal with social anxiety other than encouraging people to connect to the best they can over Zoom. The other thing I encourage people to do is if you're comfortable, and again, many people with social anxiety might have general anxieties about COVID in, you know, in general, in terms of health, can you go outside and sit with somebody who's comfortable, you're comfortable with, because I think they're going to have to get comfortable just with returning back into, you know, when things go back to normal. But again, social anxiety is very different for many people. It can manifest itself in a lot of different ways. So I don't think I have a concrete answer for Sherry.
Certainly it's a challenge given all of the dynamics of this pandemic. But Megan, is there knowing that every case is different, every person is different, is there a simple definition for social anxiety that you would use?
Again, there's symptomology for it, but it's a pervasive worry about how one is perceived by others. So in things that people with social anxiety often experience is they're very hooked into assumptions about what other people are thinking. They have ideas of, you know, perfectionism. And let me just say what has just completely thrown social anxiety, you know, through the roof was way before COVID. So this was, you know, with social media, that's what really started. Mm-hmm. It's a constant comparison. So just a caveat, like we had a mental health crisis in higher education, or I'm sorry, emerging adulthood. Cause I want to differentiate that we're talking particularly about a niche of 18 to 24 right now. We're not talking about the whole, you know, we're not talking about everyone in that age group. We have people who are working and all different other phases, you know, things they're doing in their life. But with that higher ed group, you know, they are looking more at, I'm sorry, Evan, could you just repeat the last part of the question? I got so excited.
Well, I'm just simply just trying to sort of work through how we understand it, not asking listeners to sort of diagnose themselves or a family member or a loved one, but understanding especially what anxiety, you know, can sort of, and how it manifests. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so what anxiety really is it's an overactive fight or flight freeze response in your brain. So with social anxiety, people are perceiving social interactions as a threat, some kind of a threat. So their brain, their very primitive Neanderthal brain is going, hey, this is something that is really, really dangerous. We got to get away from this because it's super uncomfortable. So, you know, they're responding to their brain telling them that, you know, and that's a part of our brain, unfortunately, that has not evolved to recognize that a social interaction is really not a life or death threat. So what we do to treat, you know, anxiety in general, not just social anxiety, is retrain the brain to recognize what's a threat and what's not. So in a social anxiety situation, going into or public speaking too, like that is your brain being like, we're about to be eaten by a tiger. So are we going to run away from this? Are we going to try and blend in, or are we going to fight? And that's the very bare bones definition of anxiety. And then what we try to do to treat it.
Do you have any thoughts when you see that Facebook announced that they are considering creating an Instagram targeted to kids under the age of 13?
Let me just mention, I was previously the director of counseling at a local college. And what we noticed dramatically it was specifically 2015, we had this dramatic increase in students looking for mental health treatment. And we looked at it, and it became this cohort of students or young people that were born between the years of 1995 and now it's up to 2012. Jean Twenge has a book called iGen. She's coined this term iGen, and it was the people that were born in that range that essentially grew up with iPhones and social media. And that we saw that between 2015 and 17, this dramatic skyrocketing in students looking for treatment for anxiety and depression.
So you're tracing a lot of that directly to social media, like Instagram, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old. And through COVID, just trying to keep my 12-year-old connected to her friends without, you know, almost encouraging that dependence on a screen, it's been a really, really hard balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's for every parent. Like, how do I keep my child connected, but, you know, be watching and, you know, on top of, okay, are you Snapchatting? Are you old enough to be Snapchatting? So when I hear Facebook saying that that's something, it terrifies me as a parent and as a therapist.
So before I get back to listener email, let me just sort of close this loop on social media, because I know it's in many ways it is here to stay. I am not trying to mock or condescend about it, but Megan Clifford, as a professional who is seeing a rise in real struggle with mental health tied to different social media platforms, we should be worried about it. I have a twin brother who teaches, and he talks about especially young girls, but boys too, the impact of everything from YouTube to Insta. I mean, it's just, it can be noxious. But at the same time, here we are in a pandemic where we're supposed to be largely apart from one another. Julia, has social been helpful? Is it occasionally harmful? I mean, do you have general feelings about the impact?
I generally think it's harmful now. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, thank God I have these technologies to be able to connect with people and keep connecting. And there was, I felt like, a sense of camaraderie on there where we were all trying to make the most of just total loss of routine, whether that was making TikTok videos or going on Instagram or watching vlogs on YouTube. And now what's happened is we're supposed to be having fun. We're supposed to, there's this expectation of needing to create things normally or watch things normally on social media. But the reality is we're still in the midst of this very unprecedented time and not feeling like we're having enough fun or we should be happier than this, which I think a lot of social media puts out there, does I think create this gap between how it is and how it seems, and that's hard to reconcile, I think, especially for young people.
And can social increase anxiety, Julia?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the idea that we can't necessarily interact as well in person, but online we're able to. And the time we spend online is completely affects our ability to interact in person.
Mm-hmm. Soren, how do you see it?
I would completely agree with everything that Julia said. I personally, when I'm struggling now, like especially during the pandemic, this has been an issue for, you know, forever, but I personally tend to use media and especially social media as a coping mechanism when I'm feeling especially anxious. And usually when I do that, it just exacerbates the problem and makes it a lot worse. And I actually just conducted a survey for one of my projects at Nazareth for people on my social media to kind of tell me about how they perceive social media affecting, you know, their perceptions of themselves and of the world and of other people. And one of the biggest things that people said was that social media makes them feel like they aren't enough. Like it makes them kind of compare themselves to other people and makes them feel like they aren't enough. And because the people who have been kind of social distancing and, you know, being really careful about precautions this whole time, you know, life maybe isn't as interesting as people who are able to be out and doing things. So I think that there is kind of an imbalance of what we see on social media versus what our lives are actually like. And that kind of creates this feeling of missing out or of not being enough. And I think that really harms a lot of young people.
Hmm. Let me read an email from a listener named Karen who is asking the following, quote, what can you do about someone who needs help but will not get help, tries to self-cure, but it has been going on for several years now? That's from Karen. Megan Clifford, I mean, that sounds like someone with a very specific question about someone they know. And Karen, we wish you well. Megan, what would you say to Karen?
Yes, Karen, I empathize with you. That's an extremely difficult situation to be in. And this is something that we actually cover in the training, Evan, that we'll mention in a moment. Mm-hmm. You can never force somebody. That's the way I feel personally as being in this field for 20 years. If you try to force somebody to get treatment, it very rarely works. So what I suggest we do is we listen, we make ourselves available, we validate the way that they're feeling, and we gently continue to suggest some options. And maybe they're not somebody who's interested in therapy. Maybe they'd be interested in, you know, or one-on-one therapy. Maybe they'd be interested in, you know, an online group, or maybe they'd be interested in something else. But staying with them and not pushing them to do something that they're not ready for, I think is the best approach, because usually it'll backfire if we try to force somebody to do something. So that's been my experience.
So tell me about what you're teaching. It's a higher education module on mental health first aid that you're teaching in May. What is that?
So mental health first aid is a public education program. It's very similar to Red Cross first aid. So what we teach is we teach people how to assess for any crisis or suicide. We teach people how to listen non-judgmentally. I think a lot of us think we're fabulous listeners, but when we break it down, we really have some opportunities for growth, especially, when maybe we don't relate to what somebody's struggling with. We talk to people about how to give reassurance and information in a way that people can receive it. Because I receive information in a particular way doesn't mean you will as well, Evan. So trying to understand the way people could take the information we're giving. We teach folks how to encourage professional help, and we also give them a comprehensive list of resources here in the Rochester area. And then we teach them how to encourage people to use self-help strategies and other supports in their lives. So that's an action plan, very similar to like CPR. Mm-hmm. We teach an action plan so people feel like they have a skill set when they notice part of the course is noticing what does depression look like? What does anxiety look like early? And then they able to be confident to say, oh, I'm going to talk to this person and I know how to talk to them and I know where to refer them or how to encourage them. Because we know the average length of time that people go between starting to experience symptoms and getting treatment is 11 years. Wow. So if we have people who understand, you know, and see symptoms early, then we can get early intervention and better outcomes. And we also know only 40% of people who are suffering do reach out and get treatment. So the earlier we can provide that education to the general public and give them that skill set, that toolbox and confidence, the better outcomes we're going to have for our individuals who are living with mental illness and the better outcomes we're going to have as a society.
Well, let me squeeze in one more listener comment. Jen emails to say, Evan, based on the show, I'm worried that social media will eventually lead my kids, they are young now, to anxiety and depression in the future. What is an appropriate age to start on social media? Julia Smith, how would you answer that? If you had to sort of weigh in on when kids should be and should not be starting on social media.
You know, it's hard because regardless of whether or not you think your kids should be on social media, their friends are going to be on social media most likely. Personally, I wish there was a world where it just didn't exist. I wish that, you know, after college, maybe where you use it in professional ways of connecting, of networking, of kind of building your career. I think that's a great tool of social media. But when you're a little kid and when you're an adolescent especially, I just worry that it will. We were kind of the first generation mm-hmm. where we were exposed to these mediums. And we've obviously felt the effects of it. And I don't think I would be able to let my kid on social media or give him a time limit for it.
Wow,
that's
strong.
That's a tough question.
Julia, there was a world without it. I came from that world without social media.
I wish I came from that world.
Man, I wish I'd go right back to Soren, 30 seconds, what do you think?
I think that it's really dependent on who your kid is and what they need and what they can handle. I'm not, you know, a professional in like child development or anything, so I don't have a great answer, but I really think just like having a conversation with your child about it if you can, and like helping them to understand how to approach it in a healthy way is really important, regardless of the age that they start using it, because it can be a great tool for a lot of things.
Megan Clifford, final 20 seconds, final thoughts for listeners as we think about depression and anxiety among young adults.
I would encourage you to learn the signs and symptoms of mental health concerns so that you can recognize them in whether it's your child or a neighbor. Learn the signs and symptoms and learn how to intervene. Please join me for Mental Health First Aid, May 17th and May 16th and 29th. You can register on my website.
And what's the website?
It's wellnessrochester.com.
Wellnessrochester.com. They'd love to see you there. Megan, thank you for your expertise and for being with us.
Thank you, Evan.
And I have to say, Soren Kilmer and Julia Smith, I know it's been a rough year, but you are both so self-aware, so articulate in understanding your own struggles, and I think you are headed for really great things in your lives, and I'm just gratified by your time. Julia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Soren Kilmer, same. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Evan.
Soren's a student at Nazareth. Julia's a recent graduate, and there's more connections coming up.